I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Last December, we spoke to municipal leaders who decided to take it upon themselves to do what they can to solve the climate crisis, with or without help from state or federal government. Today, an update on how that mission, the Metro KC Climate Action Coalition, is doing. We'll find out what steps cities and counties have already taken to improve climate resilience and if their efforts are paying off. Then, the Cinephiles return to explore how films frame the experience of girls when they narrate the story. We'll travel from modern-day Pakistan to 1940s New York to understand life from the adolescent female point of view. We'll get you up to date after the news. Frustrated by the lack of progress on climate change in Washington, locally elected leaders in the Kansas City area are now gathering to do what they can to deal with the crisis. The question that these leaders face is the same one that I asked them about 9 months ago when they last appeared on Up to Date, and that is, how much of a difference will these local efforts make without the full involvement of the federal government? This conversation comes the day before more than 500 people, including many of our other local leaders, gather at Johnson County Community College for the 2019 Climate Action Summit. With us here to talk about the local push to combat climate change are some of the organizers of this weekend's event. Mike Kelly is the mayor of Roland Park. Mike, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Thank you very much, Steve. Pleasure to be here.
Lindsay Constance is a councilwoman over in Shawnee. Lindsay, good morning to you.
Thank you so much.
Well, Mayor, let's start with this. 500 people gathering this weekend out at Johnson County Community College. My jaw drops. Why so much interest? What do you make of this?
Well, it's beyond our wildest expectations as well. And we're very grateful for all of the enthusiasm and all the work that's been done over the last year by quite a few elected officials. And really, it's just a recognition that there has been a push and work being done on the ground in Kansas City for decades, whether it be advocates or whether it be churches or scout troops or other advocacy groups that have really had this goal in mind. And now that we've had an opportunity to show the elected officials that there is opportunities for reducing climate emissions, they've really just bought in.
You know, Lindsay, I can't help but also wonder if this isn't a sign that there are a whole lot of Americans out there who are eager to advance on this issue, and they're not getting that leadership at the state or national level.
I absolutely think you are right. I think folks who are looking for leaders to take action have started looking in our local communities. And really what's been exciting is to see cities and community colleges and school districts already start taking that action together and see those benefits that are helping their communities.
You know, before this point gets away from me, I should point out that the full day registrations are sold out, 500 people already coming due to the demand. But the afternoon keynote session is free and open to the public. So there's a possibility that you can engage with this Climate Action Summit this weekend. Let's move to what's happening now, Mayor Kelly, when it comes to battling climate change here in the Kansas City Metro. What kinds of things would you point to? Because there is a lot going on.
Absolutely. And it's broad and it's commendable. One of the things that municipalities are doing that is really notable is taking advantage of the Renewables Direct program. Those municipalities that are within the footprint of KCP&L or Westar have an opportunity through the aggregation of contracts to help the acquisition of a wind farm And in doing so, these municipalities will be powered by 100% renewable energy and at the same time save money for their constituents on their energy costs.
Which municipalities are you talking about here?
Well, Kansas City, Missouri, to be the largest one, but also Shawnee, Leawood, Mission, Prairie Village, and a host of others.
Oh, just amazing. Lindsay, what would you point to, Councilwoman Constance? What else is going on?
You know, I can speak to some of the actions being taken in my city.
Sure.
We underwent the Facility Conservation Improvement Plan. We are updating our efficiencies throughout municipal operations. We've been looking at fleet right sizing so that we are being as efficient as possible with our transportation in the city. Other examples would be native grass plantings along major roadways in Shawnee and in our parks. And what's been really, really good to see is how those have those added benefits, not only saving money, but adding beauty to our city, helping mitigate stormwater, et cetera.
How tough of a sell are some of these things in your community?
It hasn't been a tough sell. That's what's also been really encouraging and giving me a lot of hope. When you talk about what are the benefits, what is the cost savings, really everyone, regardless of political ideology, is eager to get on board.
And that's one of the big things that we found to be so successful as local elected officials is that we're in these nonpartisan positions so that we can block out the noise that's coming from Washington, D.C. or Jefferson City or Topeka and show people the benefits of taking these actions as neighbors. We can really roll up our sleeves and get things done for their own sake without having to put it in a box and sell it as one party or the other.
You know, there are a lot of deadlines that seem to loom out there in the media when it comes to climate change. We have to get this solved within 8 years, 10 years, whatever the number is. You know, Councilwoman Constance, you know, in your community, to what extent do your residents, are they urging you to move forward? Are they uneasy about the lack of progress on these issues in Washington? What's the temperament of your folks that you represent?
You know, a lot of folks in my network tend to be parents with young children. As a teacher, I connect with a lot of other teachers for whom kids are their top priority. So I think for those folks in our community, it is a very, very big concern, and it's a top priority. It's actually something that's really surprised me with how eager people are to get involved and take action. I don't think I would have expected that a year ago, but I think the fact that we have such an impetus for action with these deadlines that you're referencing, that paired with the fact that people are seeing others around them take, you know, take leadership in the area is making people excited to get involved.
It's a little unusual because, you know, you build a road through Shawnee, you can see the road. But with climate change, you make these efforts, you undertake these pushes, and it's hard to see what it all leads to.
Absolutely. You know, many of these things, the goal really is to reduce emissions, reduce the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. But you're right, that's not something we can see. So that's why Mayor Kelly and the others of us working on this are really talking about the co-benefits, because those are things that people can see.
Well, what do you sense in your folks in Roland Park, Mayor?
I think the same sentiment. When you show them the triple bottom line and the fact that you can save money, but also improve access to good quality food or improving public health, those kinds of things are what government officials are supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And when people see that their government is working for them, they respond in kind.
You know, there's some news out today about a LEED certification for the Brookridge development. Could one of you fill us in on what that is? And this is that major development taking place in Overland Park. It's going to be LEED certified in a very substantial way, right, Mayor?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an incredibly exciting announcement. It'll be one of the first of its kind in the nation. The U.S. Green Building Council and the Brookridge Development have signed a memorandum of understanding that they're going to work towards achieving a LEED Zero certification for that entire 200-acre project.
What does LEED Zero mean?
LEED Zero means there would be no emissions emitting from that project. So think of something like the Country Club Plaza in that scale, not having any emissions. It would be a really amazing proof of concept for people. And Kansas City has always been a design exporter for the world. You look at the talent we have in our architects, our engineers, and our construction professionals. Opportunities like this Brook Ridge development or the Keystone Innovation District that will be coming to fruition in the coming years, those kinds of proof of concept make Kansas City a leader in climate resilience, but also a leader in these industries. And so people can see the benefits that not only this can have for our environment, but our economy as well.
You know, I think the same organization is pushing for the new airport terminal to be zero emissions as well. Any sense of where that push stands, or have you heard much?
I've heard that that's the push, and again, would be the first of its kind in the nation, and is a remarkable goal. But given the opportunities and the professionals that we have here in Kansas City, I think that's going to get done.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about tomorrow's 2019 Climate Action Summit taking place at Johnson County Community College. More than 500 folks have signed up already to attend. Full-day registrations are sold out due to the demand, but afternoon keynote sessions are free and open to the public. I'm wondering, Lindsay, how did this summit come together? How did this happen?
Well, last December, we held the workshop for 135 local leaders. And from there, it was really clear the amount of energy and enthusiasm for moving forward that there were some next steps that we should take. Mm-hmm. So together with other leaders, we formed Climate Action KC, and we have three main goals. One would be a climate action plan for the region. The second would be a climate action playbook. And then the third is the Climate Action Summit happening tomorrow. For me, I think that the Climate Action Summit is all about empowering people to know that there are things that we can do right now, wherever you stand, whether you're a teacher, whether you're a senator, whether you're the governor. So it's all about empowering and providing that information so that people know what to do.
Is one objective of tomorrow's summit to develop this climate action plan that you just mentioned?
That is something that is in the works now. We've been working really closely with our partner Mid-America Regional Council on a climate action plan. We were actually selected as one of four regions in the entire country to work through a greenhouse emissions inventory and wow. vulnerability assessment and develop this plan. So we're really excited about that. That's going to be continuing the next 18 months.
When we started this project, we wanted to get a baseline of where we were so we can set a goal of where we want to go as a region. And we looked at a partnership with what's called the Global Covenant of Mayors, which is an organization that provides technical assistance and expert advice to cities around the world. And right now, about 1 billion people live in a city that is utilizing this Global Covenant of Mayors technology. The roadblock that we came to was that they only worked with individual municipalities. And Kansas City being a region, you know, this bi-state, nine-county region, and realizing that there's an economy of scale in going about this together and really adhering to that sense of regionalism, we thought, why don't we pitch them on the idea of doing this as a region? Hmm. And through the generosity and the work of the Mid-America Regional Council's Board of Governors, they actually voted to allow us to take on this application for the nine-county region. And like Lindsay said, we're going to be the pilot project and developing this model. And, you know, like we said, Kansas City being a design exporter for the world, if we're really designing those living spaces for the world, we should also be designing the model for regional resilience for the country. And that's what we're going to do.
You know, I'm just wondering, Lindsay, how tough was it to organize something like this? You're talking about two states. You're talking about a fairly complex topic. You're playing multidimensional chess here in some ways, aren't you?
It's definitely been a challenge.
I can imagine.
However, I would say not really from lack of interest, more just the fact that we have had so much interest. We have 40 speakers confirmed for tomorrow, from the lieutenant governor to Dr. Rick Randolph from Heart to Heart, who just got back from the Bahamas helping wow. folks after the hurricane. We have such exciting speakers. So really, it's been a challenge finding out how can we let everyone plug in so that all of these people excited to take action are able to. That's been more of the challenge.
If our listeners want to join our conversation here, 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Well, I guess, you know, Mike Kelly, the billion-dollar question here is how much of a difference will all this make, and do you even know?
Oh, I think that's one of the reasons we want to get this climate action plan in place so that we can show Kansas City exactly the impact that they're going to have. And unless we know where we are, we can't really measure where we're going to go. And so we want it to be on a macro level of the entire region, but also have an opportunity to let people know on a micro level, whether it be their city, whether it be their church, whether it be their block, or even their individual home parcel, how their actions can help reach Kansas City's goal.
Right.
And when we talk about what's Kansas City's goal, we think that Kansas City can achieve that 27% reduction in emissions level, which would put us in compliance with the Paris Climate Accord by 2025. Mm. If you look at all of the action that's already taken place in Kansas City, not the least of which the actions that have been taken place by the various utilities around this country, taking advantage of our proximity to the wind corridor, we're already well on our way. And when we combine the efforts that we've taken for energy, but also energy efficient building design and transportation, and the actions and being at the crossroads of agriculture as well, we're well on our way to that goal. And when people realize that they can have an individual impact on that larger goal, it gives hope.
Yeah.
A lot of the messaging that you hear about climate change right now is doom and gloom, and that's causing some very real anxiety in individuals. And that's reasonable. It's a daunting subject.
You know, Councilman, I get the sense here that the attitude is we can only do what we can do, and we're going to do it. Is that sum it up?
Absolutely. I mean, as a mom, there's nothing I wouldn't do for my kids. And so, frankly, I am going to give it 110% and do everything I can to make sure that they have a future. And right now, I see a path. I see hope. I see hundreds of people coming together. If you would have asked me last October after the IPCC report, I was not feeling so hopeful. Today, I'm feeling better about our future than I have in a decade.
You know, and yet, Mayor, I think I asked you this the last time you were here. There are professors out there like Michael Oppenheimer of Princeton, who says things. He was a lead author of this international, one of the international climate reports. On PBS, he said this: an uncoordinated response taking place in hundreds or even thousands of states and localities just will never get us to where we need to go. This is a problem which requires national leadership. Does that dissuade you at all?
Not in the slightest. I really think that local leaders are the ones that know their citizens best. And I think, like I said to you last time, cities have been the hubs of innovation for hundreds of years. Solutions come out of cities. And us being the closest layer of government to the people really can have the greatest impact. And like Lindsay said, the momentum that has sprung in the last year just here in Kansas City, that is not only happening in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. You look at what's going on in New York right now at the United Nations meeting and the energy and excitement that is coming from that. I think we'll see a very dynamic climate strike on September 20th. That's going to be a worldwide show that people are enthused and ready to take action.
Tell me about that strike. What is that? Remind our listeners.
Well, the various organizations worldwide are coordinating a climate strike, a mass demonstration to show the governing officials that people are ready to take action, and they are ready to take that moonshot to be able to maintain a livable planet, but also enhance those kind of co-benefits. So you'll see people demonstrating throughout the world on September 20th.
Are you going to be one of them, Councilwoman?
Gosh, right now all I can think through is tomorrow, so I'll let you know.
Yeah. So what's the path forward coming out of tomorrow's gathering? Where do we go from here?
where we go from here is to continue working on that climate action plan with our partners and with Mid-America Regional Council. Then this coming December, we will be launching the Climate Action Playbook, which is a guide that's based off of some of the drawdown principles of action that cities, people in cities can take right now, because we want to communicate to our leaders that you don't have to wait. You can do something now. And so that will be launched in December. And so it will be another opportunity for leaders to have concrete things that they can do to make a difference.
You know, Mayor Kelly, as you scan the list of things that municipalities can do when it comes to climate change, are there other things that are sort of sitting out there that you've got your eye on that the area needs to be thinking about?
Well, the biggest ones are energy and transportation. Now, there are things that we can do individually, but in terms of the largest amounts of emissions that we emit in the metropolitan area, energy, buildings, and transportation are the big ones.
So what could we be doing? What are the big pie-in-the-sky ideas that loom out there?
Well, a more coordinated transportation system, and I think Mayor Lucas and Councilmember Bunch have a great idea in making public transportation and the bus system here in Kansas City free and increasing ridership. Things like that are going to go a long way in helping Kansas City reach their goal.
Well, those free fares, could that also possibly extend to the Kansas side of the state line? Have you heard much about that?
Well, that's a goal that we're going to be working towards. Increasing ridership would not only provide a great momentum for the environment, but also empower a lot of individuals in the urban area to take advantage of opportunities throughout the region. And yeah, that's what it's about, regionalism. I'm so glad that we are taking these regional steps at the same time that the governors of both states have signed an understanding. And Mayor Lucas and I gave a press conference that day. That sense of regionalism goes a long way. And Kansas City, as a region 2 million strong, can take some amazing strides. And we're very excited for that.
Lindsay, what else is on your sort of bucket list here?
You know, I'm really interested to see what we can do with native plantings. I think that is just one of those practical, simple solutions.
My neighbors
that will go
and I have been kicking around that idea in our own neighborhood. It's like it's time to make the change.
Absolutely. You know? It's something we're really looking at in Shawnee, and I'm really excited to learn more about that, too.
Yeah. Anything else, Mike, you'd point to that you're thinking about?
Well, I think there's a lot of good opportunities to show proof of concept. And one of those that I wanted to make sure that I express my appreciation for is Johnson County Community College. Mm-hmm. They've been a partner on this from the very beginning. And Dr. Jay Antle and President Sopcich have been partners in allowing us the opportunity to not only host the summit there, but to champion some of the work that they have done there at the campus, making Saturday's keynote part of the Polsky series for personal enrichment gives an opportunity to have almost up to and above 1,000 people wow, listening to Paul Hawken, and their partnership has been amazing, and we very much appreciate it.
Let's go to some calls. Marty, you're on the air. We're talking about the Climate Action Summit taking place tomorrow at Johnson County Community College. Good morning.
Hi. I've kind of instigated a group of neighbors that are getting together. We call ourselves the Neighborhood Climate Coalition, and we're trying to do stuff at the neighborhood level. One thing we're doing is we do biochar out of the sticks that fall from your trees. You can sequester carbon in your own garden. We're having a little picnic on Sunday between 11 and 1 over at Luce Park in the Grove, and it's just neighbors. It's not very well, it's well organized for what it is, which is not to be organized. it's to allow everybody to talk and get together and see what they can do and take ideas back to their neighborhood. It seems to me that the people that live close to one another, transportation is one of the drains,
right?
Biggest producers of CO2 in the atmosphere. And so if we can do something in our homes with our neighbors, make friends, and we don't have to drive to friends that are across the city or something, you know, it would be better. So,
all right, anyway. Marty, That's a good way to wrap. Interesting that even we're seeing progress on the neighborhood front here. I want to thank our two guests who are here representing the 2019 Climate Action Summit. They are Mayor Mike Kelly of Roland Park, Lindsay Constance, a councilwoman in Shawnee. Good luck tomorrow. We'll be eager to see what happens.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the experience of girls in film. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. You can sign up for Kraske Off Mic at kcur.org/Kraske. It's my weekly newsletter where you can read what guests from the show got me thinking about and get highlights from the up-to-date team. All that in your inbox every Monday. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske. Well, imagine you're moving, and rather than packing things in boxes and a truck, you just get some aircraft to lift your house and move it to a new location. On Monday, XKCD creator Randall Monroe explains why he offers absurd solutions to basic problems. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. You know, for years, the film industry has faced criticism for its failure to be more inclusive when it comes to women and people of color. Well, the Kansas City Public Library is launching a new film series that deals with part of this question with a look at the diverse roles of girls in cinematic storytelling. How do films tend to frame the experience of girls when they narrate the story? Today, the cinephiles are here to run us through a series of films that will take us from modern-day Pakistan to 1940s New York. With us, Erin Hammerbeck is a communication studies instructor at UMKC. She's also a lecturer in the liberal arts department at the Kansas City Art Institute and an English instructor at Metropolitan Community College Longview. Erin, nice to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us again is Mitch Bryan. He's a screenwriter and film professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I think we know each other from there, too.
Yeah, I've seen you around
there. Nice to have you here, yeah. Well, Erin, why did you want to get involved with this series at the library that showcases these diverse roles of girls in cinematic storytelling?
Well, when I was in graduate school, I took this amazing class called Girls in Print Culture that was taught by Dr. Jane Greer, and it was such a profound experience.
Wow.
Seeing these, you know, print, you know, from anything from like zines to scrapbooks to actual books like Little Women and, you know, Toni Morrison books about girlhood. And I started to think, like, what about girls' storytelling through cinema and, you know, the cinematic experience, movies, television, music, videos, commercials, all of the ways in which girls are being represented in media. And I thought, you know, that might be a fun class.
An idea was hatched here.
Exactly.
Getting back to your college days here,
yeah.
It sounds like. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mitch, women and girls have had a lot of struggles when it comes to making their way in the film world. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think what's most interesting is the fact that there was a time in Hollywood when this was not the situation, when there were a lot of female producers and directors and even studio people, you know, and that was happening in the 20s and in the 30s. And then suddenly, as the Henry Ford automobile model of production starts to take over, these women are suddenly shipped away to the costume department or to the – a few stayed in editorial, but art direction and
– makeup.
And I can't explain it. I don't know, Erin. I
mean, so the industry started out a lot more inclusive, Mitch, when
much
it came
more
to
inclusive.
Men and women?
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the history of cinema, you know, in its experimental phase, there were filmmakers like Alice Guy Blanchet, who arguably created the first narrative film. And you had Lois Weber, who was a pioneer screenwriter talking about hot topics like capital punishment and abortion in films. You even had like June Mathis, who was the highest paid executive in Hollywood in the 1920s over anyone, not just highest paid woman in Hollywood, like the highest paid Hollywood executive. And then this switch happened as soon as filmmaking started to become lucrative. That's when men started taking over these key roles.
And then the door slammed hard, shut pretty hard here, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, it was actually incredible because Dorothy Arzner, the director of Dance Girl Dance, she is one of the very few women to maintain her role in production after the silent film era, because it was really the switch from silent film to talkies when women stopped, you know, kind of being able to obtain these production roles.
So where are women today, Mitch? Give us some context. Are they where they need to be? Is it still a long battle here that's being waged in terms of them having sort of equal footing with men in Hollywood? How would you characterize it?
They're definitely not where they need to be.
Yeah.
I would say that the last couple of years, you've seen more of an attempt by studios to hire female directors, to get involved with scripts that are written by women. But, you know, it's a constant battle. If you think about just, I think it was maybe 10 or 12 years ago when, at that time, the head of Warner Brothers said that Warner Brothers was never going to get behind a movie that had a female action lead. And thankfully, that changed, but there was a huge tradition of female action leads coming out of Hong Kong cinema and lots of other places prior to that kind of a statement. So, you know, it's getting better. It's not getting better fast enough, but it's happening.
And Aaron, it's kind of amazing because most people consider Hollywood as this liberal bastion. If you can't find a quality in a place like Hollywood, then where in the world can you find it?
I know. It's incredible to me. And I don't know if this is still true, but I know that statistically, it used to be said that, like, in current film production roles, there were more women in, like, directing, cinematography, editing, screenwriting, and producer roles in the 1980s than there were, like, a couple of years ago. So I don't know if that's changed. Hopefully it has. But that's troubling.
Where are the areas of filmmaking where women are most underrepresented? Is it directors and producer, the top job?
I think so. You know what is really amazing is that it's just certain genres. Because, you know, when you look at documentary and experimental film, you see tons of women working in the industry. I mean, they're rolling out documentaries far faster than male directors are. And so it's interesting that they're interested in more of, like, sort of that storytelling perspective.
Interesting history, Mitch.
Yeah, definitely.
A lot of stuff to unpack here. Okay, let's go to some films that our guests have brought that sort of begin to talk about the experience of how girls are framed in films. Aaron, you wanted to begin with a film, Dance Girl Dance.
Yeah. This is a 1940 film directed by Dorothy Arzner. Like I mentioned, she's one of the very few women to come out of that silent period with a production role. And, you know, she worked for Paramount and she had a kind of tremendous control. They allowed her to select her production team. So she got to decide who she wanted to have in these key roles. And I found this quote that I thought was really interesting. She claimed that, quote, I was not dependent on the movies for my living, so I was always ready to give the picture over to some other director if I couldn't make it the way I saw it, which I thought was really interesting. Like, she wasn't so
invested.
Yeah. And maybe that's, you know, her flexibility was what allowed her to do a lot of these movies. But she was also in a long-term relationship with a female dancer. So in the 1940s, if you can imagine, like, she had to kind of keep that private. But she has this wonderful, like, feminist rebellion in her films. And Dance Girl Dance is an amazing hallmark of that. We have Maureen O'Hara, who plays this dedicated ballerina, opposite Lucille Ball, who plays this sort of, like, carefree dancer in the troupe. You know, she's kind of brazen and out there, and it's so funny.
There's a name.
Lucy Ball. She's fantastic in the movie. I mean, just everything that you would ever want from Lucy. She is that and more in Dance Girl Dance.
What's the clip we have here we're going to listen to?
So this is a scene where Maureen O'Hara's character is auditioning for a part in a burlesque dancing role, which she's not exactly good at because she's a little too prim and proper. So Lucy shows up.
This is from Dance Girl Dance.
Very nice. Neat, in fact. Classy.
What a great showman you are, Mr. Kajulian.
Very classy. Too classy, in fact. Look, I run a dance and drink place, not a kindergarten.
But, Mr. Kajulian, you do not understand. She could do it different. She could do it how you want.
What my customers go for, she ain't got.
Wait a minute, Mr. Hoboken.
Bubbles.
Hello, madam.
Mr. Kajulian, now we got what your customers go for.
I ain't got an ounce of class, you're honest.
Can you dance?
Well, it's been called that.
Where was Lucy in that?
So she's Bubbles.
That was her.
That was her at the end.
So yeah. She's told by her, well, Maureen O'Hara is told by her dance instructor, which was the Russian voice you heard, which was Maria Ospenskaya, who is a famous character actor who came over from Russia, that they're training at one point. They're trying to hire somebody to dance the hula, and Maureen O'Hara can't quite do it. And she says, yeah, if you're going to do the hula, you need oomph, and you don't have any oomph. But Bubbles has oomph. So Lucille Ball is the one with oomph all the way through.
She's got lots of oomph.
But there is an extraordinary moment where they address the men in the audience. And they just say, you know, basically, we're sick of you paying your money to come and look at us and treat us like we're objects. And it's a really – and then the women, there are women in the audience and they start applauding. And it is a great feminist statement.
Yeah. Yeah. That feminist rebellion is all it's so there. And it's amazing. It, once again, from a female director, 1940, to break off in the middle of the film and have that kind of fourth wall destruction.
That's really interesting. Because you don't think of the 1940s as being a time of this kind of rebellion.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Not at all. Not at all. I mean, the 1940s, like Mitch said, you know, it's that Ford mechanism, right? We were just making movies. And, you know, you had a part to play in cranking these films out. And so to make something this subversive is really, really interesting.
Okay, let's move on to our second film here today, Mitch Bryan. This one is titled Ghost World.
And this movie is showing on what day?
This Sunday, September 15th.
This Sunday at the library.
This Sunday. Yeah. It's going to be at 1:30 Sunday at the Kansas City Public Library, the Plaza Branch. Aaron, you're going to lead a discussion of this film afterwards,
uh-huh.
I think, right?
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
So like Dance Girl Dance and like Booksmart, which we'll talk about later, you know, this is another one of those movies that has at the center two women, two very close friends, and attempts to examine the complexities and frustrations of these kind of friendships, you know, and I think that that's if there's a theme with the movies today, that's one of the ones that's holding all of this together. But Ghost World is about a couple of sort of alienated girls that just get out of high school, played by Thora Birch and Scarlett Johansson, and trying to figure out what to do with their life. And one of them sort of plays an anonymous prank on this older man played by Steve Buscemi, and then feels guilty about it, and their paths cross again, and they strike up a friendship, and she decides she's going to take care of this guy's romantic life. But he starts to fall in love with her. And so it's really interesting because it was made in like 2000 or 2001, and it still feels like a 90s movie. It has that kind of dry, indie, laconic kind of vibe to it. But I think it's an interesting movie because it gets complicated when you start to think about the fact that it was written by men, directed by men, and the girls are kind of positioned as there's a certain objectification that's going on here. And there's a certain sense of like they have this power, and poor Steve Buscemi, he just doesn't have the tools to handle the kind of power that these young women have, you know. And I don't know whether I'm reading it against the grain, whether the filmmakers were intending that, but it makes for a really interesting conversation piece.
Okay, we have a clip here from Ghost World, Mitch.
Yeah, and they're discussing the realities of men in the world that they're in right now.
Let's check this out.
Which band is yours?
It's Alien Autopsy.
Oh, Bitchin'.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll see you there.
Yeah, thanks. God, what a dork.
You're just jealous.
Trust me, at this point, I'm past the fact that every single guy likes you better than me.
Oh, face it. You just hate every single guy on the face of the earth.
That's not true. I just hate all these extroverted, obnoxious, pseudo-bohemian losers.
She doesn't hate every guy, just those ones.
Yeah. Why have I not heard of this film, Ghost World?
I don't know, Steve.
I mean,
what were you doing in 2001?
Yeah, who knows?
Other things?
Just missed it, yeah.
Yeah, it's good. It's an interesting contrast to something like Booksmart, which we'll get to a little bit later in terms of the similarities and also the differences.
In this panel discussion you're going to do on this weekend on Sunday at the Plaza Branch, Erin, what points are you going to make about this film that you think people should be aware of?
Well, it's interesting because we're doing it in connection with the original graphic novel, so kind of looking at the adaptation perspectives, you know, how the film is adapted from the graphic novel, the differences, the similarities. Because the graphic novel was written by a man as well. And so we have these men trying to identify with, a girl, on the fringe, outskirts of society and these types of things. And so it's really kind of interesting when you look at the characters from like an anti-hero perspective, because you don't see a lot of female anti-heroes. And I think that it has a lot to do with audience expectations of girls. And, you can hear in Thora Birch and Scarlett Johansson just kind of, this monotone, kind of they're over it all kind of thing. Whereas, it's definitely like sort of a 2001 male perspective of a female anti-hero on the outskirts of society.
And there is lots to talk about with the ending, and I'm not going to say a word about it. But when you come see the movie, I'm sure you guys are going to talk about the ending.
Absolutely.
A lot.
Yep.
It's a wing dinger, eh?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about how films tend to frame the experience of girls when they narrate the story. We're visiting with Erin Hammerbeck and Mitch Bryan. Let's move on to another one here, Erin. This one is titled "He Named Me Malala."
Yeah, I think it's impossible to think about girls' stories without encountering a lot of the girl rebellion as a form of activism. And, this has been, present in our society, everything from like Claudette Colvin and Ruby Bridges during the civil rights to these current amazing girls like Malala Yousafzai and Emma Gonzalez and Greta Thunberg, these girls that are using their rebellion as a way of social change. And this film is a documentary about Malala. And it's really a beautiful examination of her life, because I think that I had always imagined Malala as this superhuman.
And who's Malala again?
Malala Yousafzai. She is the girl who was shot by the Taliban Pakistan, and she was shot by the Taliban because she was an advocate for girls being educated. And she's the youngest, I believe she's the youngest Nobel Peace Prize winner.
Right?
And because of all of those incredible accomplishments, I thought that she was just like the most amazing girl in the world. The documentary is lovely because it shows her as this girl that struggles to get good grades. I mean, she's such an advocate for girls and education, and yet she's like, do you want to see what grade I got on this test? Yep, I got a 67%. It's amazing to me.
What's the clip we're going to hear here?
So this clip shows Malala's bond with her father, who is a teacher, and kind of talks about how they're both kind of equal advocates for education.
This is from "He Named Me Malala."
When she was very small, many friends used to come to our home. We used to talk about politics. We used to talk about the basic rights. And she used to sit with us.
When I was younger, I used to listen to him. Like, what is he saying, how he talks?
We became dependent on each other. Like one soul in two different bodies.
Who would you have been if you were just an ordinary girl from the Swat Valley?
If I was an ordinary girl in Swat Valley, I'm still an ordinary girl. But if I had an ordinary father and an ordinary mother and a family, a conservative family, then I would have two children now.
Okay, that film again, "He Named Me Malala." Okay, Mitch Bryan, we hold in our hands the last film of the day that we're going to be talking about as we span this conversation about how films tend to frame the experience of girls. This last film is titled Booksmart.
And it just came out on home videos. It's a 2019 release. And it's remarkable for a number of reasons, the first one being that it was directed by a woman and it was written by four women screenwriters. So it is definitely a girl's perspective movie. White girls, for sure. San Fernando Valley white girls, upper middle class, middle class to upper class white girls. But nevertheless, it's a particular Los Angeles kind of girls movie, right? Mm-hmm. And the complexities of the relationship, the way that that they communicate to each other, the importance that they put on friendship, all those things are front and center. And the value of conversation, despite how crazy the movie gets. So Beanie Feldstein, who's Jonah Hill's sister, is one of the leads, along with Caitlin Dever. And they play these two girls who, it's the last day of their senior year. They're super overachievers. They've gotten into great colleges. And they suddenly realize that they did this without partying or having and yet everybody else who's going to great schools has been partying all year long, right? Mm-hmm. And so they take it upon themselves to go out and have one rip-roaring night and
make
up for it all in one night.
Yeah. Well, what's the clip we're going to hear from Booksmart?
So this is when it's really landing on them that they've spent way too much time overachieving and they need to get out there into the world.
We're just going to be the girls that missed out. We haven't done anything. We haven't broken any rules.
Okay. We've broken a lot of rules. One, we have fake IDs.
Fake college IDs so we can get into their 24-hour library.
Name one person whose life was so much better because they broke a couple of rules.
Picasso.
Yes, he broke art rules. Name a person who broke a real rule.
Rosa Parks.
Name another
one. Susan B. Anthony.
Damn it.
Amy, I'm so serious. They think that we're robots. They think all we care about is taking a million APs and getting into Yale and editing law review at Georgetown and clerking for a federal judge between junior and senior year before eventually becoming the youngest justice ever nominated to the Supreme Court of the United States. In my case, you get the point.
So what's the perspective you get on young women from Booksmart, Mitch? What's your sense?
I just think that, it's about the sense of frustration and powerlessness that, and mm-hmm. trying to find your place in the world, trying to find your power, trying to obviously find somebody that you can care about, that cares about you. Mm-hmm. And then it's about doing a lot of drugs and having a big night out. You know, it's kind of like super bad for girls. There's one really great scene where they're tripping and they imagine themselves to be Barbie dolls and they're trying to walk around and move with the disproportionate shape of a Barbie doll, and it's really, really funny.
That's funny. Erin, have you seen this film too?
You know, I have started the film. I've watched about the first half hour, and it's fantastic. I'm definitely going to get back to it this afternoon.
Again, I should point out that Erin will be talking about this notion of showcasing the diverse roles of girls in cinematic storytelling. It'll be on Sunday at 1:30 at the Kansas City Public Library, the Plaza Branch. If folks want to come, how do they sign up to come?
So there's an RSVP online. If you just Google the Kansas City Public Library film screenings, you'll find that this is the first film of four that will be taking a look at. You can RSVP online.
This series will go on through the fall then, it sounds like.
Yeah, we've got three more films lined up. In October, we're going to take a look at Eve's Bayou. November, we're going to take a look at a 2011 film called Circumstance, which is about an Iranian family. In December, we're going to take a look at Paper Moon, which is Peter Bogdanovich's film.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I want to thank our guests for coming in today. Erin Hammerbeck, Communication Studies Instructor at UMKC. Also with us again, Mitch Bryan, a screenwriter and film professor, also from UMKC. Thank you both for an enlightening conversation. Appreciate it.
See you next time.
Good luck
with
the program.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well. Yesterday on the show, gun sense activists in Missouri attributed a recent spike in gun violence to relaxed firearm laws in the state. You can hear that and other previous episodes. You'll find them at kcur.org/uptodate. What's the outro? What are we listening to here?
This is from Ghost World.
Ghost World, okay. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. We're back next week with Randall Monroe, whose stick figure webcomic XKCD is riddled with satire. He'll bring his free-thinking approach to problem solving. Apparently, there's a lot to learn through ineffective ideas. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.